All right, welcome. Hello and welcome to Community Quest episode 427. I'm your host, Mike Apps, aka Wheels, and with me as always, I think.
You can't prove shit, man. Save it for anything.
Allegedly present, your man in Japan, Michael Baker, Gaiji Minogatari.
And this is Smokin' Joe Gamer with no clever quip today.
Did either of us actually have clever quips already in it?
No.
Okay.
Just that kind of day, huh?
Yeah.
It's been snowing quite a bit over here where I am, and it's going to get very, very cold next week.
Cold never bothered me anyway.
I will put you into the goddamn ground.
Let it go, go.
Speaking of video games.
While I was waiting for everything to start up, I was finishing through Little Witch in the Woods, which remains very cute, and I've almost maxed out the encyclopedia entries on all the animals that I'm collecting from. Yep. One or two of them are a little trickier to pull off, or just for some of the setups, but my favorite continues to be the fluffy pink dog thing that carries a mushroom around, and in order to collect from it, you have to keep grabbing its mushroom and throwing it so it keeps running through puddles and gets too wet to continue.
Huh.
And it's just, it's adorable. Either that or you just hit it with a potion that soaks it immediately. Much easier.
Oh no.
Yeah. Yeah, just a cute game, some nice stories, and I'm trying to remember how poorly I described some of the issues with localization from Japanese and Korean to English involving direct address and pronouns, and I've been reminded a few times while playing it today. Things like forgetting to put in you or your and just using the person's name instead. Yep. Happens a lot. And a sign that you're definitely dealing with a Eastern Asian language. Okay. Yep. But still fun, and aside from that kind of issue, reasonably well translated. So that's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, who's next?
Let's let Joe talk.
Sure, I'm currently playing. Okay. I'm playing Metroid Prime 4. I've made significant progress over the past week, and I love this game. I think it's great.
Yeah.
There are a few spots where I got a little frustrated, but it's Metroid, you know? Like, you're not supposed to be able to beat every boss first try every time. You know? Sometimes it takes two or three tries, and that's okay.
That's a video game, baby.
And then when you do get it, it's like, oh, I did good. It turns out I didn't need to blow that much ammo. Okay, cool. So, so I'm just in an area that really feels like it was inspired by the Alien movies. I mean, the whole series is.
It's Metroid.
So, but it's like, this area is just like, oh, I like what they're doing here. This is interesting. And I just had to fight a very tough enemy. And, like, I've been doing a lot of side content, a lot of exploration, you know, and like I keep finding missile tanks, and I'm like, do I really need all these missiles? And I'm in an area where I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm glad I went ahead and got all those things, using up quite a bit of ammo here, and it's actually neat. So I don't know. What I can say is this is the exact game that I wanted it to be. It's what it's beyond my expectations. I haven't read any I've heard of negative statements. I haven't really looked into any of that. I haven't read any reviews. And sure, like if people are saying yeah, it feels a bit dated, yeah, maybe. And, you know, but I don't think that's a problem at all. And you could say it plays it safe a little bit. Fine. It's a good game. It's a prime game. And I like being like
dated. There's like very little that actually plays like Metroid Prime.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, I don't know. I don't know what people are saying, and I don't care. Because I can see how, like obviously it's not perfect. No game is. And so there's a few spots where I could be like, oh, yeah, I could see why someone might complain about this very specific thing, but none of it bothers me. I don't know. Like, Miles McKenzie is awesome. I don't know what people are complaining about. He's really cool. So I like the game. I can acknowledge that maybe it's not for everyone. Maybe there's people who prefer the 2D platformer entries, and that's fine.
Oh, don't worry, they complained about the last two of those too.
I know, they just complained about everything. So I like being Detective Samus. I like scanning every object and reading all these funny lore entries and descriptions of items, and I scan every enemy, and I think that there's some backtracking because it's Metroid. And every time it sends me back somewhere that I've already been to get like a new power up, I always end up finding additional, you know, missile tanks and stuff. And I think it's well designed. I can see how the map is kind of more horizontal than vertical. Like in the other games, you just have these elevators going up and down. Now this, you have that big kind of desert area that you drive across, and that acts as like a hub area to all the other regions. And I think that's neat. And you've got a base camp, so you're actually encountering other humans, and you help them, and they help you, and then you've got this nice base camp where they hang out, and you go to visit, and they're like, yo, Samus, what's up? And I think it's neat. You know? So, I always liked how Metroid Prime 1 and 2 had kind of this non-invasive storytelling, like they didn't bombard you with dialogue and cutscenes, and a lot of the story was told through lore entries just from scanning objects, and I always thought that was neat. And I remember playing Dark Souls for the first time, and that kind of did something like that too, except that you had people to talk to who could drop hints and or just say completely batshit crazy things. So with Prime 4, Prime 4 reminds me of Dark Souls in a good way, just having this kind of like hub area where everybody goes to hang out after you rescue them, and they can drop hints and stuff. And I think that's neat. And what I like though, is like one of the characters you encounter, she's like, Samus Aran. Oh my God. Like she's a super fan. And one of my favorite things in the game is just this idea that, oh, wait a second. Samus is like a superhero. She's a celebrity. And people like her, they respect her, and her accomplishments have been acknowledged in this world. She's, you know, she saved their asses so many times from the damn pirates, and this is the first time that somebody was like so excited to see her, like a total fangirl. And it's just like, wow, like, okay, I'm good to know that Samus's contributions to the universe are not being unnoticed. That's all. So don't want to spoil too much more. There are some changes, and like I was saying before we started, you know, the power-ups are similar, like they're kind of familiar, but they're a little different in a good way. Like you get these familiar looking power-ups, but each one has maybe some functionality that it didn't have before. Maybe there's a new kind of puzzle that the other games didn't have, and it's pretty neat. I just really like this game. And like my playtime, I think, is already 10 hours, and I don't think I'm going to beat it anytime soon. I think this is probably a 15 or 20 hour game at least. So that's the main thing I wanted to talk about, is just Metroid and how awesome it is.
Metroid good.
And I was thinking about how like Super Metroid never explains like how Samus lost her power-ups and how she had to get them back. But I always liked how each game like kind of has an explanation. So like Metroid Prime was, okay, she gets attacked, she gets electrocuted, suit malfunctions, and she lands on another Chozo world where she's able to find new power-ups. That's neat. Metroid Prime 2 is really cool because she gets mugged. Basically, like these Ing warriors attack her, steal her shit, and then they're able to use it against her, and you have to fight them and kill each, you know, little Ing guy to get one of your power-ups back. I'm like, that was really creative. And now this one is like, okay, yeah, her suit gets damaged, she loses all her stuff, okay, fine, but now she's on a world that's not a Chozo world, but it's not too different, and there are similar technologies that she can utilize, so I like what they did there. Yeah, really cool. So other than that, just last night for shenanigans, we were just doing Pokemon Legends EA, and I've still been streaming it, and I think I'm getting close to the end of the DLC, but I just finished the Pokedex with some help from Wheels, doing some trades.
Wouldn't give me your Mimikyu, you monster.
I caught an Alpha Mimikyu, and it was the only one I had, and I was not going to give it away.
Oh.
I love Mimikyu.
You guys are going way deeper into the end game than I am ever going to go with that game.
Okay. Well,
in part because I'm not willing to pay a subscription fee to be able to trade Pokemon.
Do you need Nintendo Online? Oh, yeah, you do.
Yeah. I didn't think of that because I'm on the Wheels family plan.
Unfortunately, I ran out of spots where I had you on, Gaijin.
No worries.
Also, I'm pretty sure that like there might be issues with regional shenanigan.
Yeah. No, I had a Japanese account on there.
Find out if there were.
I had a Japanese account on there before it, and it didn't cause any issues whatsoever.
Weird. The last game in the series I bothered to play was Sun, and that was before they shut down the Wonder trades. And before that, I was playing Sword, and I don't remember if I even bothered trading anything on Sword. Right now, I'm like, yeah, there's at least 5 Pokemon I just can't get right now because I can't trade and no alpha version of them is showing up. Oh, well.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, in Zone 20, any Pokemon can potentially show up as an alpha version, but
I know
it's only...
I got an Alpha Gengar. I got really lucky the first time I walked under there. Oh, here's one I don't have.
And that's it.
And then one of the Alphas that I had to beat up before Xerneas shows up was an Alpha Steelix.
Oh, I got one of those. Yep.
Steelix
is a broken Pokemon. He's OP.
Yep.
He's so awesome.
But yeah, that's how I have 2 tradables and only 2. With 5 left to get, not counting Slowking, because I have the Galar Slowking instead.
Hmm.
It was really cool with his funny hat.
Oh, I just found something that will probably require a power bomb to activate. I don't have
power
that
bomb
yet. Because I'm like, I know, you know, you know what you're getting in this game. You know what the power-ups are going to be. But like I said, they found creative ways to make each one a little more interesting and give it some added functionality. Right. So hold on. I started talking about Pokemon, but there was something else I wanted to say about Metroid. What was it? Oh, it was just the fact that, like... Well, so I'm going to say 2 things. So one of the things, of course, we like about Metroid and Metroidvanias is... While you're exploring, you may see some kind of contraption or device that you can't interact with or a door you can't open. And it's like, oh, I'm going to come back here later and see what's in there. You know, so like in Super Metroid, you get the power, you get the super missile, and then you're able to open green doors, that sort of thing. So, yeah, so Prime 4 absolutely has that, of course. So you see some really cool looking contraptions. And then when you can finally use them, you end up getting a missile tank. Right? And so part of me was just like, oh man, what's with all these missile tanks? It's so boring. Couldn't they have done something more interesting? But then I thought, well, no, dude, like, what did you expect? What did you think you were going to get? Like, it's Metroid. You get energy tanks, you get missile tanks. That's it. Like, did you think you were going to get some secret hidden hyper missile or ultra missile? No. Like, so there are some neat puzzles, and your reward is a missile tank. Or an energy tank, And there's also a separate ammo system now for other types of shots. So it's like, yeah, I was like, okay, like, what did you want? Like, you're not going to get something different from every one of these puzzles. So it's fine. It's Metroid. So then, yeah. So in Legend ZA, it's like, I've gotten a couple of good Pokemon from Zone 20, yeah, that showed up as alphas. And some of them are so damn stubborn, though, and they won't stay in the damn Pokeballs. Mm-hmm. And I accidentally wasted my Master Ball.
Oh, no.
No. Really?
Oh, no. I have yet to catch a Skarmory because it only appears in one spot, and that spot happens to be located between two different alphas that keep respawning.
Yes, the Alpha Pyroar.
And the Alpha, what's her face, Mawile.
Right.
And for whatever reason, if Alpha Mawile, if I get up onto the roof without alerting all the kitty cats below, and the Alpha Mawile just starts roaring, then the Alpha Pyroar will start attacking me. From two or three stories down, he can still hit me with some sort of ground fire attack.
Yeah, and that can potentially be a good farming spot if you have Feraligatr or Blastoise. And you can Mega Evolve and just take them all out. But I've tried to do that and absolutely gotten wrecked, too.
You have to pull a couple of the Lionesses away first. I have taken out the entire crew before with a Gyarados. And then went up to the top to try to get a better shot at that Skarmory. And the things respawned while I was attempting to get the Skarmory.
Skarmory took me a few tries because it wouldn't stay in the Pokeball. And then I had to wait for it to respawn. And the other one that's really hard to find is Drampa.
I just got one of those yesterday. It was the first time I'd seen it actually show up in its zone. And it shows up at, like, exactly at dawn.
Yeah. It's only during the day, and it won't spawn if there's the alpha poodle thing in the gazebo.
Okay.
Yeah, I had to look that one up, too, because I'm like, where the hell is this guy? And
I got Alpha Clefable to show up more often than Drampa.
Yeah.
Like, all
right. Yeah. So some very cool stuff in that game, too. And my only shiny is the one you get as part of a quest, and it's like, well, I didn't really earn that one. But I did get to research level 50 and got the shiny charm. So hopefully some of those will pop up before I get bored and finish the DLC. And Alolan Raichu cannot Mega Evolve, which is just bullshit, but it's all right. So I ended up getting...
Preposterous.
Yeah, it is. But I did find an Alpha Raichu, and he's a big boy. He's like three times the size of a regular one. He's like taller than the trainer. I'm like, holy crap. I found a female Mr. Mime, and I'm like, okay, well, I obviously you're a Mrs. Mime, so I, you know, changed her name. And I found an Alpha Machamp, and I was gonna name it Goro because of the four arms, but then it was a girl. I'm like, oh, Shiva. Okay, cool. Yeah, I like to come up with neat nicknames. So then I went into a Hyperzone portal that had a whole bunch of alphas all over the place. So I got an Alpha Binette, and that's where I got the Alpha Mimikyu. Actually, what happened was there was a whole group of Mimikyus, and they kept shooting my trainer with Thunderbolt, and I died and then immediately quit out of the game before it autosaved.
Oh, no.
So I was able to go back in and actually catch one. But, oh, man, some of these Pokemon, man, they will not stay in the Pokeball. Like, I feel like there needs to be either Master Balls need to be more common, or maybe Ultra Balls need to just be better, or maybe there could be another one in between, like a Hyper Ball or something.
I know, I just like, there's so many of the little random specialty balls, and trying to just grab the right one to use in the heat of the moment can be very annoying.
And that's how I lost my Master Ball to a freaking Alpha Sableye that I didn't even want.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean. Aside from the standard ones, I think the one I've used most often was the repeat ball, just because I ended up getting a bunch of them through quests and just randomly finding them all over the place, and wanting to catch a lot of Eevees and other things.
Yeah, so Eevee only spawns in two or three spots and doesn't stay in the Pokeball, but you can get a higher level Eevee in the Hyper Dimension DLC.
I mean, I found at least three different locations that have Eevees. Two of them are on rooftops, both near the corporation's name is in English.
Quasartico.
Yeah, there's two different rooftop spots near there that spawn them.
Yeah.
One more often than the other. Plus, I think one of the zones actually has Eevees show up occasionally.
And also in, I think in Zone 20, I have gotten Alpha Jolteon and Alpha Leafeon.
I had an Alpha Glaceon show up.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. And I was just thinking, man, if you wanted to get all the Eevee evolutions as shinies, you'd have to, what, find, like, a whole bunch of shiny Eevees and evolve them?
What kind of fucking psychopath are you if you're doing that?
Yeah, I know, point. That's what I'm saying. Who would even do that, and how would that even work? And not me.
It would work by not doing it and making better uses of your time.
And then
for example, by hitting yourself in the dick with a hammer.
I would never
It'd be much easier to do and much less painful. You get
it done way quicker.
It would be less painful.
It would be less painful.
No, Legend ZA is great. And first, you get the berries. Then, you get the donuts. And then, you get the candy. That's great.
Yeah.
Then I got Mewtwo as part of that quest that you can do. Oh, and another cool thing happened. So in the hyperspace dimension, you keep finding Gimme Ghoul coins. And I'm like, well, there's got to be a Gimme Ghoul around here somewhere. Well, I accidentally stumbled into the side quest that you get them from. So you just see this guy. He's got a Gimme Ghoul. And he's like, oh, I'll give you my Gimme Ghoul if you promise to evolve it right in front of me. I'm like, sure. And then the dude gives you 400 additional coins. Maybe I had 600 to start with. I don't know. But So then I evolve it. And then he's like, oh, that's amazing. Can I have it back? And I said, no.
Yeah.
So I have a Goldango now. And so trying to level him up, which is actually pretty easy because you get a lot of large and extra large candies in hyperspace. Yeah, no, I think it's a cool DLC, but the thing is, I've put like 70 or 80 hours into the game now at this point, you know, and I've been streaming it for RP Gamer. So this week, I'm actually going to go back to Rune Factory, Guardians of Ozima, and they're going to send me a copy of East 10 Proud Nordics to stream when that comes out. So that'll be my next streaming game on RP Gamer. Yeah, so I find that's my payment is every few months I can be like, hey, pause. Can I please have this upcoming game to stream? You know, just gotta ask nicely and don't abuse it. And I offered four or five other RPGs I already own to stream, and pause was like, no, I want to watch you stream, you know, East 10. I'm like, okay, yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool. So that's
of Nordic.
Right. So that's what I've been playing.
Yep. Association with the site has been helping to fund my video game addiction for almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the only other game I've been playing, I had noticed that God of War Ragnarok was on sale for like $20. And I thought, well, let me go back and finish the first one, or, you know, the previous one. I don't know like why I fell off of that. Right. It's like, I like it. There's things I like. There's things I don't like. It can be frustrating. It's a difficult game. Some of the puzzles are obtuse and the controls are weird because, like, dodge is the X button instead of circle, and you got to double tap it. And so if I play a different game and then go back, then it's like, oh, wait, I got to kind of relearn it. But I do want to see where it goes. And, you know, Ragnarok did get like perfect review scores, game of the year and stuff. It's like, all right, let's see what the fuss is all about. I'll pay $20 to see where this goes. Like, Kratos isn't a very likable character. He's more likable in this one, but really Atreus is the real star, and I kind of want to see how his story pans out. And Dave, you had posted something.
God of War games are for middle-aged men, so
they really only care about Kratos.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you had posted something on Blue Sky about, like, kind of a bad script carried by good performances, and I think I agree with that.
Like, yeah. Every God of War game, like, Kratos has, like, an incredible vocal performer. Like, TJ, I think it was, like, TJ Carson before, and now it's, like, Christopher Judge, and both of them are, like, doing excellent work with scripts that are just, like, the most divorced middle-aged man garbage you've ever seen.
Yeah. Right. That, yeah. So that's my impression of it, and but like I said, you know what, I'm committed enough where it's like, okay, let's see how this ends, let's see where the story goes, but yeah, and he's a little more likable in these ones because he's, you know, now it's not like a quest for vengeance, it's a quest of a grieving husband who wants to fulfill his wife's dying wish, and I thought that was neat. And then I also got Stellar Blade on sale, which I probably don't have to talk about too much. It's basically Dark Souls with a pretty girl, but I actually am starting to get the hang of some of the perfect dodging, perfect parries, and it helps that you can spend ability points to get to make it easier to do those things. So at first, the game kind of turned me off because I kept failing the perfect dodges, perfect parries, but then you invest skill points the right way, and you just kind of get better at it, and some of the enemies are pretty easy to read, actually. So that's another game that I picked up. And beyond that, I do have a pre-order on Mario Tennis Fever. Guys, I got a fever, and the only thing that can cure it is more Mario Tennis.
I was going to say more side quests, but okay.
Okay. All right, someone else can talk now. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
He only needs 3 minutes.
I've been playing things.
Things?
I've been playing a lot of Destiny. Mm-hmm. Trying to solo the new dungeon, which I completed this weekend. And a lot of Hollow Knight, because my son is going through a challenge of Metroidvanias to be able to play Grand Theft Auto later this year. And this, me playing...
It's going to be sad when Grand Theft Auto gets delayed in 2027.
Yes. Yes, it is. This all started with me playing it at the same time as him when I was watching him try and beat a boss. And it was like, no. I need to teach you how to bounce off of enemies. And then I wanted to go and get fight some of the bosses he was too so I could help him. And now I'm just playing through it and getting near the end. And I've come to the conclusion that Silksong kind of sucks ass and Hollow Knight is better.
I don't have strong, like, I played the first few hours. I did not have terribly strong feelings about what I experienced.
Silksong or Hollow Knight?
Hollow Knight.
Yeah, I didn't like Hollow Knight either. That was my impression too, like, very early on. I don't like this game. And then once I started unlocking the abilities,
like,
I'm not saying
I don't like this. It's, I have no strong feelings about this at all.
No, I'm saying I had the exact same experience. Like, I have no strong feelings at all. It's pretty. It's just kind of whatever. And my opinion improved the farther I got into it. Whereas Silksong was the opposite, where it's like, wow, this is pretty, and I have some cool abilities and stuff, and my opinion of it progressively worsened. And from what I heard of the later acts, I bowed out at the right time.
Like, it does seem to have been designed as Hollow Knight for super players. It's the kind of game you get when you start out as DLC, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll probably play more Hollow Knight eventually, but, like... I don't think I'm going to get much out of it because I'm just kind of sick of the whole paradigm, but I'll get around to it. It's getting the Switch 2 update soon. Maybe that'll be a good excuse to reactivate my dormant attempt.
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to come out as soon as I finish the game.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Thanks for getting that out so that I won't have to worry about it.
Yeah. But apparently my son's going to take a break and going to start up Super Metroid, so that's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, that game's only like, even a long playthrough, that's only going to take him like 8 hours. It'll be fine.
I think he's going to blow through that and have a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all a video game. People like the Super Metroid.
I love it. And it's like multiple games in one, because there's just your regular casual playthrough, but then you get into speedrunning, or you want to do a completionist playthrough, and then when you start messing around with all the glitches, it's
and like now you totally hate Meridia with all of your heart and soul.
Right. You know, mm-hmm. Then you try doing combo randomizer and you get stuck in Meridia with no gravity suit.
Don't do that.
I've done it. It sucks.
I didn't say that you hadn't. I said don't.
I'm not going to do that again. Yeah.
Like, Super Metroid's a game I like, but it's not a game I love enough to do that to myself for. So, you played anything else, Wheels?
I've been playing some Legend of Heroes, Trails in the Sky, second chapter, trying to finish that up. I'm in chapter 7.
Oh, yeah. My copy of Trails Beyond the Horizon just arrived, which means I just need to get through all those other games that I need to fucking finish.
Yeah, I have mine too. I'm going to put it on the stack of collector's editions.
I'm just sitting on top of my copies of the Daybreak games.
It's going to be weird going through the series, because it's going to be like, okay, I'm going to play third chapter, Trails into Zero, Trails into Azure, and then continue my 40 hours of Cold Steel 1, where I am stuck
40 hours? You should be nearly done with Cold Steel 1.
Where I am stuck in a haunted house, underleveled.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're like a chapter away from being done, and you've been stuck in that haunted house for 4 years.
Yes.
4 more years. 4 more years.
No. If I'm bored, I may actually just fire that up and start grinding levels before I actually go back to it. I need to do that.
Yeah, I need to like push through my Cold Steel 2 playthrough that I'm like partway through, but it's intimidating. It takes time. I have to be in the right mood. I'm finally playing games again. I was off on vacation and visiting people, so I had less time for games. Gonna keep pushing through Expedition 33, still very much a 7 out of 10. We'll see what happens. That's all I have to bring up.
Okay. Yeah. We got 11 or 12 questions already from you-know-who, so we could get right into those if you want.
We should probably do that, because otherwise I feel like a huge jackass for just rambling about our own shit.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hit some easy ones. Okay, there's a bunch of Sega stuff here. Let's talk Sega.
Yeah, let's do that.
Sega. Okay. Okay, I'm gonna hit these. Okay, people. Okay. How much is the question of fan ownership apply to delisting because of remasters and remakes? In other words, are the delisting of Yakuza 3's remaster and Kiwami 3's price strategy anti-consumer practices? An accusation that has been thrown at Sega so many times lately, or is this a question of Sega wanting new fans to do with this specific route, this specific story continuity? Western fans have their idea than a lot of Japanese IP holders care more about control than money. So, for those who've missed this particular kerfuffle, like what happens basically every time Sega does a remaster, they have removed the ability to directly purchase the previous version of the game. So the Yakuza 3 remaster is going to go away in terms of being able to individually purchase it. You can only purchase Kiwami 3, its remake. You can get the remaster officially without seeking out secondhand like Steam keys or whatever by purchasing an exorbitantly expensive full series bundle. There's probably a few reasons for this. The obvious one being that they want people to play the recent version of the game. Mm-hmm. It's admittedly a very hard, weird feeling to jump from Kiwami 2 to 3 Remastered. 3 is a very old game. Like, 3 turns, like, 20 next year. And it feels it. It's definitely like the very earliest of the modern behind the back Yakuzas, instead of having like absolutely horrendous like fixed camera angles. But I think that ultimately what you're looking at is about exactly what you'd expect, which is to say, Sega has more than most any company I can think of been very much wanting to create very specific perceptions of its IP. And it's willing to do a lot to make that happen. They did a bunch of, like, back in the day, they did a bunch of, like, delisting Sonic games that had scored horribly because they wanted to raise the perceived value of the brand. To this day, they'll take away certain, like, you can't buy the individual PC remaster of Sonic CD that existed unmolested for a number of years, because now you have to buy Sonic Origins. Sonic Generations went away when like Sonic X Shadow Generations is now the only version of that you can buy, except in, similar to Yakuza, an extremely expensive, like, full series bundle.
Yeah. And you also can't get, you can't buy the Genesis Sonic ROMs on Steam anymore. You gotta get Sonic Origins, I think.
Plausible. But yeah, broadly speaking, like, this is something that Sega does a lot as brand management, but the phrase anti-consumer is so broad as to not be terribly useful, which is why I don't really bother with it. Like, anti-consumer means a lot of things. Like, basically anything that says, like, and especially because it's such a hot button among people that are just, that just have unreasonable demands. You'll hear it among people that are saying, like, well, it should be available on everything. And, like, you could coherently make an argument that something costing money is anti-consumer because it means certain people can't get it. And it's like, yeah, I mean, technically, but, you know, like, not relevant or, like, meaningful. Do I think that it kind of sucks? Yeah. Do I get why they do it? Yeah. I mean, like, we see this a lot. A lot of times, like, companies will, because, like, I do have to look at the flip side, which is to say, I have seen how people react to being able to make uninformed decisions. And I know for a fact that there would be people who, like, will stare at it and be like, I don't know which one I'm supposed to play, like, and then, like, get mad because they got the wrong one or whatever. So to a company like Sega, it's just like, yeah, here, now you can, unless you're really trying to, you can only buy the version that we think you'll like better. And, you know, I don't think that's ideal. I don't like that, but, you know, it's honestly, this is less insane than some of the other shit that they've pulled. Like, I will never get over the time that they tried to copy strike basically anything referencing Shining Force to try to on YouTube to try to get them to force the like almost instantly forgotten mobile game that they were promoting at the time to be at the top of any searches for Shining Force. They just, like, DMCA struck everything they could find.
That was wild.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, yeah, this is less insane than that. Like, this is still, to them, it's the compromise. Because originally, like, the first time they pulled this shit was Sonic Generations for Sonic X Shadow Generations. And then when people got mad, they said, okay, you can still buy original version, but you have to get it in the big bundle. This is them doing that again. The other thing I'll say is that, like, these are not hard to get hold of if you really want them. There will be third-party key sellers that will still sell you this. You can, the PS4 version of this collection of 3, 4, and 5 is extraordinarily cheap and has been for years. Like, it's a physical version. Like, I'm sure eventually it will stop being cheap, but, like, if this is something that's going to concern you, there are options. Options exist. But yeah, like, it kind of sucks, but, like, I don't have like, there's so much worse that even these same companies have done that I don't have time to spare for it. It's like, this sucks in a mostly normal way, but I mean, like, I could just as easily point out that, like, it's really hard to get hold of the non-remake Resident Evil games, and I think that that's a huge shame. Like, that sucks in ways that I think are worse than this.
Oh, those are on... Actually, those are all on GOG and GOG. PS5 yes. now.
Yes, those... When I say it's really hard, I mean it took a very long time to happen.
Oh, okay. Right. And then I think, like, physical copies might still be hard to track down. Yeah.
Well, physical copies, of course, are going to be hard to track down. But, like, digital is supposed to alleviate that. And, like, until last year, digital was not doing anything to alleviate that. Like...
Okay.
That's what I'm getting at.
Okay. Gotcha.
And, like, it's worth noting that, as has been mentioned by various statements by GOG, the desire to get those working on GOG was not something that was internal to Capcom. Like, it was outside force comes in and asks them, can we get this to happen?
Mm. Let's see. Just see how Toei can control Kamen Rider, which led to the Western market being neglected for years, though you can sympathize with the fact that Toei nowadays relies too much on the TV broadcaster and sponsors, so they don't want to do anything that can jeopardize that relationship. I think, like, the other thing when you look at those kinds of things is that, like, Kamen Rider had a very dedicated niche English fan base that if you attempted to that would not have been worth attempting to sell to. And we see that a lot, is that, like, you know, there were attempts to sell Kamen Rider in the US in essentially the same way that they tried to sell Power Rangers, which is to say,
yeah,
we have just created a new show around some of the footage. And
it's like, I know that there's, like, a term for when that happens, when you take footage from a movie.
There's all sorts of slang that sits around with that. Let us not dig up the past, but they,
yeah.
Suffice to say, it is an old practice. But broadly, like, you know, the answer was that at the time there was no meaningful way to distribute it that made sense, that could possibly have been worth the opportunity cost. Like, you know, the thing, as always, with any of these, with something like that, is, yeah, they could have tried to market it in the U.S. again and thrown good money after bad, because it had failed to make money the same way that other Sentais had in the West. Or they could accept that, like, you know, even if they could find a way to make it make money, it probably would not make enough money to be worth the juice, would not be worth the squeeze, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I think that there was, until modern periods where you have digital distribution, you don't have to work out a TV deal, you don't have to convince one of a handful of major networks that they should air this, and that and convince advertisers that the motorcycle alien man beating people up is going to sell toys. Mm-hmm. Like, without all of those barriers, with where you can just, like, pay someone, like, you know, sub minimum wage to subtitle a show and then throw it on a streaming service, and then, you know, maybe sell some Blu-rays if it seems like enough people are responding. Without that level of direct marketing, like, the idea just never makes sense. Just to speak specifically of something like Kamen Rider, like, I don't think that was ever going to happen. Some snarky people will say that the fact that Daytona USA 3 remade the tracks from the original Daytona and not Daytona 2 shows that the sequel failed. It failed because a Daytona game is nothing if it can't wow people as a tech demo. In other words, just how compelling is the core gameplay of Daytona USA? I've asked similar questions applied to Panzer Dragoon. I think the problem with Daytona USA 2 is it's a 2000 arcade game.
Yeah,
like, I don't think it really has much else to do with anything but that.
Didn't it get ported to Dreamcast or something?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
It was arcade only. To be clear, it was a 1998 arcade game, but it's also a Model 3 arcade game. And okay. Model 3s were mind-numbingly expensive. There's like 7 Model 3 games. Like, the big one was Virtua Fighter 3, which Virtua Fighter never had a huge footprint outside of Japan, and Virtua Fighter 3 is the unpopular one. The other ones are primarily games you've never heard of, like Spike Out and Fighting Vipers 2 and Scud Race. So, like, the big deal Model 3 games, like, the only Model 3 game you probably saw in an American arcade, in like a normal one, was like Star Wars Trilogy Arcade. Like, it was late. Like, our arcade games that were on expensive bespoke hardware were on their way out, and there were just never as many Daytona USAs, Daytona 2s, and it never got a home port because Model 3 to Dreamcast is hard, and Naomi to Dreamcast is the same hardware. Like, the Model 3 was kind of a dead letter by the time that the Dreamcast came out. They ported Virtua Fighter 3, but they, you know, that was it, because it was Virtua Fighter and that was their big launch marquee in Japan. But yeah, like, the reasoning here is not something so much as like, oh, Daytona 2 was bad or a failure or insufficiently wowing. Just whoever saw a Daytona 2 arcade cabinet?
I've never
seen one. So that's kind of it. Like, this is more a sign that Daytona 3 is a nostalgia grab, and it's relying on a thing you might have actually seen, like, because Daytona 1 was ported a million times. Like, Daytona, instead of getting a Daytona 2 port, the Dreamcast got another Daytona 1 port to try to fix it. and Fireminer brings up, speaking of Daytona, has anyone ever seen a Scud Race cabinet in real life? No, never. I've never seen a Scud Race cabinet. Yeah, I don't know that I've ever seen... Okay, yeah, other than Star Wars Trilogy Arcade, I don't know that I've ever seen a Model 3 cabinet. And Star Wars Trilogy Arcade came out right before Phantom Menace and right after the special editions were in theaters again. So it's kind of a special case.
Yeah, I don't think I've been in an arcade in over 20 years, and it was in...
Well, that's when these would have happened. But by that point, like, you know, arcade games were getting to the point where they were niche, and a normal place would have cheap ones or ones that they had for a number of years. Like, there was a pizza parlor near me that had, like, Raiden Fighters and The Simpsons Arcade. The movie theaters near me had Star Wars Trilogy Arcade, Area 51, and a Cabela's Big Game Hunter. Like, the arcades, like, the expensive arcades, because, like, bearing in mind that the Model 1, 2, and 3s were all based off of an extraordinarily weird series of chips that Sega had, like, purchased from Lockheed that were originally for, like, aerospace simulations.
Huh.
And so they were expensive, top of the line, like, boards that tended to require expensive cabinets. In the same way that, like, you never saw a lot of CPS3 cabinets either. There were, you know, like, I don't think I ever actually saw Street Fighter 3 in an arcade until, like, recently. Like, yeah. There's an arcade in downtown Seattle that, at last I checked a couple years ago, had a Third Strike arcade cabinet. But, like, that was not a... In the 90s, when the games were new, I never saw an SF3 arcade cabinet.
Yeah, there was a local arcade had Alpha 3.
Yeah, Alpha 3 was common because that was a CPS 2. Right.
Exactly.
If you had Super Turbo and you wanted to upgrade, you could upgrade to Alpha 3. But, you know, CPS 3, like, that was going to be a whole ass investment, and your options for what to put in it were JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Good luck selling that. And Warzard, a.k.a. Red Earth, and Street Fighter 3, which has none of the Street Fighter characters that people cared about.
Right.
So you just ran into, like, these big expense. Like, you'll note that Capcom almost immediately abandons the CPS 3 and starts making all of their latter era arcade games on, like, Naomi. Like, that's why... Or, like, it goes CPS 2, brief dalliance with CPS 3 that doesn't really go anywhere to Naomi. So, like... Oh, sorry. There was just a very loud plane flying over me. Mm-hmm. But CPS 2, CPS... like, CPS 3 never really goes anywhere. Naomi ends up just taking the mantle. Okay. To continue with the questions, even when Virtua Fighter 3 and 4 couldn't wow people with their visuals like the first two games, I mean, if you'd actually seen Virtua Fighter 3 in 1996 when it first popped up in Japan, like, that game is fucking beyond anything anywhere close to it. Like, I genuinely, like, would challenge anyone listening to this to go look up Virtua Fighter 3 Arcade and then... with the context that it showed up in summer of 1996 in Japanese arcades. You can say that developers spent a lot of time innovating the gameplay, but we're talking about fighting games with very high technical ceiling and much unexplored territory. How much can you innovate on arcade-style racing game or liking games? You see some interesting things. They tend to end up with very bespoke cabinets late in the day. If you've never seen something like... Police 911, which is kind of trying to do, like, what if Time Crisis, but more so.
Was that the game where you actually have to stand on a platform and crouch and duck? Yeah. So, what I was going to say before is just that I think the last major arcade I went to was in Old Orchard Beach in Maine, and this would have been 2002, maybe. Or 2003, and yeah, and that they had that game, and it was like $1 per play or something like that.
Yeah, you'd get these enormous bespoke cabinets that required an enormous initial investment to play anything, because it's like, well, this is how we're getting people to pay for these expensive cabinets, is that they're spending a fucking dollar for 20 seconds of gameplay before they get absolutely wrecked.
Yeah. No.
But yeah, you see that late in the day. There's some interesting late in the day attempts that, like, sort of bridge the gap between, like, a light gun shooter and a traditional FPS. Like, you'll get weird shit like Resident Evil Gun Survivor 2 Code Veronica, which I have played an arcade cabinet of. I played it many years after it was germane, when, like, the weird nickel arcade that existed near my hometown had somehow gotten hold of some cabinets of that. That's an extraordinarily weird game, but that is a light gun game that is also kind of an FPS. There are ways to innovate on these, but I also, like, bearing in mind that I don't think that they're things people seek out a lot of innovation on, they're just fun, I think that they ended up squeezing out of what made sense for an arcade, because, like, people like light gun games are especially in the most cursed position, because the most accurate light guns relied on CRT technology. You can't really do that anymore. They're getting harder to repair and keep track of all the time. You can get that there are modern, like, pure pointer motion LCD arcade games. They don't feel quite as good for a multitude of reasons, but they do exist. But ultimately, what you run into is this unfortunate crunch that kills these kinds of games from both ends. I don't think people necessarily need innovation, but they, because they don't need innovation, like, they kind of plateaued how much technologically anyone needed out of an arcade racing or shooter. Like, you know, they were gonna look like they were gonna look good enough. Making more expensive versions of them didn't really make a lot of sense because the market was dwindling anyway, because why go to the arcade? What is the arcade offering you that you couldn't get at home? So you run into this situation where, like, these kinds of ethos die off because every game has to be sold at retail and is probably going to be at least $40. So, you know, even the most popular, like, arcade light gun games have difficulty surviving. Arcade racing games exist, but they turn very different because they end up turning into things like Burnout 3 Takedown in the mid-2000s. It's like a huge arcade racer that does really well, but that's still very different than what you would get in an actual arcade. It's arcade inspired. It's the same base concepts, but you're getting very different ways of doing an arcade racer because you need to sell someone something for $40. And if that game is 15 minutes long and has four tracks, then people will be pissed.
I was going to say, just judging from the remaining game centers in Japan, the primary racing game is Mario Kart.
Yeah, there's still Mario Kart arcade GPs everywhere. Like, I've seen, I saw several in several arcades that I visited over the past month.
There are several more recent examples of light gun games, but they're usually like expanded or remade versions of House of the Dead or similar games. There's also at least one version of Luigi's Mansion.
Yep, that is basically a light gun game.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is technology that has survived in Japan to an extent, but it's...
Yeah, and you'll still find those ones specialized.
And just the number of game centers is slowly decreasing. The handful that I remember or that still exist have been around forever at this point. But they're all they're pretty much all connected to shopping centers. All the older independent game centers I remember, they're all gone. Some of them have been gone for like 15 years now.
Yeah, a bunch of the companies that owned them have gotten out of that business and they've slowly died off.
Isn't Sega's main business still Game Center?
No, Club Sega's are over.
Okay, Namco.
I think Namco might still own some.
Yeah, it does still own some in my area, at least one that I know of.
Even
then, it's a game center plus bowling alley plus the city's largest gacha machine shop. So,
yeah, I was going to say, to your point, I got Sonic R for Christmas 1 year and absolutely just beat it that day, if not that morning.
Because five crafts, I believe.
Yeah, and that was, what, a $50 or $60 game, you know? Yeah.
I remember Sega having the madman's dream of releasing 18-wheeler American Pro Trucker on PS2, Xbox, and GameCube with zero expanded content. If you have ever played 18-wheeler American Pro Trucker in an arcade, that is a 15-minute video game.
Oh, no.
Didn't do well. Did not do well.
I've always respected Sega for not being afraid to be totally freaking weird, and it works more often than not, I would say.
Yeah. Go that far. Sega at the time was mostly willing to lose money hand over fist because someone was constantly paying their debts.
Okay.
How did Sega survive as long as it has?
a man named Isao Okawa up through late 2000 essentially paid off all of their debts over and over.
Why? Basically, sugar daddy.
Basically, he just loved the company and wanted to see it succeed, and so just like CSK Holdings, which you will see like Sega attached to, especially a lot at that time, owned a lot of their debt and basically just forgave it. Okawa wanted them to get out of the console business after the Saturn. The people like within Sega didn't want to. He acquiesced and put a whole bunch of money into marketing the Dreamcast. That failed spectacularly. You'll note that they leave the console business like a month before he dies. Isao Okawa was underwriting all of their spectacular failures.
That's wild.
Okay. So one more thing in this chain of questions. In other words, did Sega see Panzer Dragoon Saga as a whatever spinoff, or did they think the franchise just had to change genre if they wanted it to expand? I think it's not quite either of those things. I think it's, oh god, RPGs are popular and we've got basically nothing. Like the explosive popularity of RPGs in that era caused them to cast around for anything that would fill that void, because it was not the Saturn's strong suit. You had Grandia, that game's great. You had Shining Force scenarios 1 through 3, definitely important pillar for them. They made 3 of those fucking things, but also a series of games that went through extremely rough development, and Sega and Camelot never worked together again. So like not a great time. And of course, I think when it was announced, it was Azel Panzer Dragoon RPG. So I think it was very much considered a spin-off that was just like, well, Panzer Dragoon is popular and it has like a really identifiable aesthetic design, so that's what we're pushing for that. In the same way that like when Shenmue was first pitched, it was Virtua Fighter RPG.
Okay.
And like they were looking at their existing franchises and trying to find something that would fit the mold of, we're making an RPG because RPGs are a huge business and we don't have a strong foothold in that. Like even look at like Sonic Adventure, there's a bunch of RPG elements that have just been infused into that Sonic video game. Because RPGs are big and we don't have a foothold in that genre. Here's Skies of Arcadia. We somehow pissed Phantasy Star down our legs during the entire Saturn generation, but here's Phantasy Star Online. There's a whole bunch of attempts to make RPGs happen for them at that point, and I don't think that they'd given up on the idea of Panzer Dragoon the rail shooter, because on the Xbox they made Panzer Dragoon Aura. I think that it was really just down to like, what do we have that we can make an RPG, because RPGs are big and we've been caught flat-footed by that. Okay, I need to step away for a couple minutes. I will be back.
Okay.
Okay.
Can anyone else grab the next question? Because I cannot scroll it at the moment.
All right, hang on. I'm fighting a boss in Metroid, and he's kicking my ass. Let me see. Oh, the question about Anno and Tomino is spread out in 2 posts. Okay. I don't know what that means.
It means the question about Anno and Tomino is spread out into 2 posts. What are those things?
I don't know. Hold on.
I Okay, Mr. Burns, what's your first name?
People like Anno and Tomino because they are weird and their arts are kind of singular, but doesn't mean you just have to take in both the good things and the bad things. I think it's important to distinguish between merely liking an artist and actually being their fan. I don't know who either of those names are. Sorry.
Can you say them again?
Hideaki Anno and
Hideaki Anno.
Okay.
Tomino. Those are the creators of Neon Genesis Evangelion and Mobile Suit Gundam, respectively.
Okay, I should have known the one of those. Okay.
Okay, let me pull up the quest. Okay, it's a question about the one back here. I jumped to the Sega ones because I figured that more people than me might have thoughts on those. Put a bunch of Evangelion Gundam fans in a room, and there will always be someone at the back asking why wasn't Hideaki Anno and Yoshiyuki Tomino taken off the production when their depression started showing in the products. We talked about how work of art is partly owned by the audience, but is it fair for the audience to demand from one of the workers to be dismissed from the production? Their presence is perceived to deteriorate the products. So, a few things. There was a lot of desire to get rid of Tomino on Bandai's side. Quite infamously, like, part of the reason that G Gundam is an alternate universe with a different showrunner is that allegedly Bandai thought that it would be easier to get showrunner Yasuhiro Imagawa to play ball with them. Infamously, he didn't. there was definitely corporate internal pressures that desired that. But ultimately, I don't think there can be any healthy dynamic where the audience is calling for a specific person's head, because the audience doesn't know what the internal structure is. Especially when a work is in mid-production, the understanding of the mental state of Tomino or Anno during the production of, say, Victory Gundam or Evangelion was not well understood, and the audience just calling for a random person's head is pretty common. Just whoever they happen to know about. Ultimately, the audience will frequently call for the head of whoever happens to have spoken publicly. Because that's all they know. And so I don't think that there can be any healthy or useful, the most that the audience calling for an individual creator's head can do in most circumstances is that it, alerts people to the fact that they're unhappy, but it doesn't even necessarily speak to it usefully to how much of the audience is unhappy either. And ultimately, a lot of what you'd get out of that is that audiences would complain that the work challenged what they wanted, and you'd get even more reactionary creative production from corporate productions. Obviously, there is a tendency towards reactionary politics from corporations, mm-hmm. but more specifically, when I say reactionary, I mean, in the literal sense of do the opposite of whatever we think pissed people off, is very common, to acquiesce
to ways to piss them off.
Yeah, to acquiesce to what the audience says it wants when the audience is generally as a whole, even if they can all agree they don't like something, they can rarely diagnose why. The reason that, assholes us will spend hours perseverating on, well, what was wrong with this, why didn't I like it, is because it's hard. It's hard to figure out what you didn't like about something versus what is the aesthetic, the aesthetic unlikability of it conceptually. Like, there's so many things that people say they don't like, and then you just wrap them in the right presentation and the audience goes for it. And so just listening to what the audience says it doesn't want is unhelpful, even when it's in the abstract. When it's something as specific as this person is ruining this, it's even more of a problem, especially because, like, you know, honestly, like, you know, as much as people will say, like, Anno's depression is the problem with Evangelion, if you take out Anno's depression, it's just a really boring show. Like, there's just not that much to it. Like, if you take out, like, the... Like, I don't think Anno's that interesting a subject. So, like, that's why I don't love Ava. But, like, if you take out the parts where he's just miserable, what you get is... Like, yeah, buddy, I saw a whole... I have seen every show that this is a melange of from the 70s because you're just a fucking nerd that got... ended up, like... at a semi-successful fucking like because Gainax always wore its fucking heart on its sleeve in terms of the things that they loved. Like, yeah, buddy, I've seen Ultraman too. I've also seen a whole melange of 70s and 80s super robot television shows. I know exactly what you watched. Without that, you get something deeply uninteresting.
Ready Player One.
Like, what's that?
Ready Player One.
Yeah, kinda. Like, if Gainax, without any sort of without misery involved, produces something that is like in that wheelhouse of just like, here's a bunch of stuff I saw that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, Tomino is, like, even when Tomino was not depressed, he was always, like, you know, kind of a guy who wanted to do things his own way, and that's why Gundam shows ended up compelling. If you have someone who doesn't have anything to say produce something, you get Gundam Seed, which sure worked out well financially, but also is fucking trash. Like, as much like, you know, that's what you get when you produce, when like someone who doesn't have terribly strong things that they want to express make a Gundam show. But yeah, I'm sure that like Bandai was much happier working with Seed because and its whole creator until Destiny kind of divided people, but you know, in general, like that whole thing probably was much easier for them. They liked that a lot better than having to deal with Tomino being like, I'm gonna make a show that shows that I have like extreme issues with women that I need to deal with. But you know, at the same time, I'm gonna make something that like actually has some sort of thing to say. I remember there was a very good way I heard this described that I very much enjoyed by the YouTuber Big Joel, where he was referencing that he brought up the movie 300, which, if you're at all familiar with the underlying themes, there's a lot of somewhat gross like fascistic themes underlying the way that film is told and shot.
Mm-hmm.
And but he brings up the very good point that even though what it's like implying with its themes is disgusting, it's still more interesting than if it didn't have anything, than if it wasn't doing that, because it's not empty. It has something nasty to say, but it's there's something there, and that makes it more interesting than if it were just empty.
What just hit me?
But, yeah. A particularly egregious example that happened recently had to do with One Punch Man fans trying to get someone on the Season 3 production team fired. It led to the point that the director had to delete his Twitter, while the animators had to publicly explain all the budget cuts and deadline crunches they had to endure. Yeah, that's... You basically hit what I spent, like, 20 minutes, like, rambling about. But basically, fans can see something wrong sometimes, but they can never diagnose what it is. The answer, if you see something like a One Punch Man Season 3... That didn't happen because people didn't give a fuck. If they didn't give a fuck, the show just wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Like, when you see a public disaster like One Punch Man Season 3, what you're seeing is a bunch of people trying to make something, even though it is a labor of Hercules to make it happen.
They're succeeding, or they're doing something in spite of everything, not because of it.
Yeah, and it's like, obviously in this case, you know, the thing that was produced was a disaster, but like, the reason it's a disaster is not because of the people making it, it's because of the unreasonable set of expectations placed on them between the extremely well-received first season and the amount of time and money and manpower they were given to produce another season, despite the fact that, you know, if this was a healthy production, it also wouldn't have taken 5 years since season two to have happened. Like, clearly everyone involved was absolutely fucked over. People like Anno and Tomino because they are weird and their art is kind of singular, but doesn't mean you just have to take in both the good things and the bad things. I think it's an important distinction between merely liking an artist and actually being their fan. I think that, like, ultimately, if you want interesting art, you're going to run into... You're going to produce... You're going to produce weirdness. And, like, obviously, you know, unless you're the, like, as a fan, you just sort of have to decide how much you want to engage with that art. But, like, ultimately, there's nothing else you can do. Like, you know, if you're someone who has control of the purse strings, obviously you can move things. But as a fan, like, you just kind of have to take what you get. You don't have useful ways of monitoring the production or changing it. And trying to, like, call for someone's head misguidedly is not helping. Okay. I'm gonna admit, I feel like I need to just, like, end this, like, soon, because I'm...
Yeah, that's fine. It's getting late. We started this kind of late to begin with.
Yeah. Okay, tell me, speaking of independently produced things made by individual authors, tell me where I can get books.
Okay. Well, thank you, dude. Thank you. So, again, I mean, sadly, for lack of any better marketplace to manage this, these are all available on Amazon, Kindle, and Kindle Unlimited. Trust me, if there were a better alternative, we would probably all be using it instead, but there is not as yet.
Yep.
Experimentation continues.
Amazon account.
Yep. Yep. All due apologies, but it's a one-man show over here, sadly. So, yes, we have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. If you enjoy tabletop role-playing games or watching other people enjoy tabletop role-playing games, or largely failing to get along due to tabletop role-playing games, then we have an adorable little young adult fantasy series, again, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu, currently 13. Not quite sure how far into episode 14 I am on writing, because it's a new notebook, and I don't know, can't estimate the word count very well, but mostly done with episode 14, working on it.
and 5 side stories and a paralogue. So there's a lot to read. I will eventually reach my threat of passing War and Peace for length with this thing. Should be soon. Yeah. Mm. And then other than that, we have Tanuki is a Teapot, Japanese folktales all about animals with illustrations by the author, because nobody told me I could not. It's been fun. Also, I'm about 15 stories for a volume 2 so far. I need about 7 to 10 more, depending on how long they end up being. Always working, always working. And then going on. This is growing into an ever longer list, guys. We have in the more recently ongoing development of subgenres known as lit RPG. Don't ask exactly what the definition is, because you won't find anyone agreeing on it properly, which means it is completely in the spirit of role-playing games. So we have Vainglorious Longs the Night, which is thematically all about B-movies and stylistically kind of inspired by Metroidvanias. All of this is on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. Same author. And then different author's name, because honestly, there are some audiences that you do not really wish to have overlapped when you're trying new stuff. There is A Wager for Wanderlust, which is, travelogue, romanticy, and like I said, not something I want the young adult fantasy audience to overlap with. But that's under the name Michael Spearwater, Spearwater. It mostly just exists there. Financial success is not something to be expected from independent authorship, or even fully published authorship, it seems at times. So just if you are in need of any reading material, check it out, let me know, leave some nice words, I will shall be happy. Thank you. To look forward to the future. But if I had the wherewithal to just commission like a bunch of book cover art right now, I'd probably have 10 more books out this year. Just constantly working forward. So there shall always be more to come. Okay, hey Joe, what do you know?
All right, so right now you can still find me on RP Gamers Twitch channel, which you might be watching right now. So Tuesday and Thursday nights I do live streams, usually starting around 9 or 10 o'clock. And as I had mentioned earlier, I've been doing Pokemon, but I want to go back to Rune Factory for a little bit, and I'll be doing East 10 Proud Nordics on PS5 whenever I get that in the mail, so that's still a month out. And at this point, I haven't been streaming much on my own personal Twitch channel, and I haven't put up any new YouTube videos since last month, but you can look up Smoke and Joe Gamer on Blue Sky Twitch or YouTube if you'd like to follow and like and all that and see what's going on. So all I did recently on YouTube was just a series of videos where I kind of just did short little like reviews and gameplay videos of games I liked from 2025. It was called Holiday Buying Guide, so there's videos for Mario Kart World, Sonic Racing Cross Worlds, a whole bunch of other 2025 games, so consider checking that out. And just give me a like and a follow and whatever, and I can also tell you I'm active on the RP Gamer Discord server, which you can join. It's a good community, it really is.
Yep. You can ask us questions there. You can also ask us questions by doing as your friend Fireminer did and asking when we're streaming live at hopefully 8:30 p.m. Pacific, 11:30 p.m. Eastern on Mondays. But sometimes that time can slip. You can also ask us questions on comment section on RP Gamer Random's episode or in the podcast section of the RP Gamer Discord, which you can get to by going to rpgamer.com and clicking the community tab. Otherwise, we also have our sister show Shenanigans, which is at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sunday nights. Otherwise, I think that about wraps it up for us, and I'm going to shitpost us out. Don't do this to me, Discord.
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man
to
you.
I do not want to spoil what's happening in Metroid right now. I don't want to spoil it, but it's like, oh, I'm getting so mad here.